Welcome to Success Made to Last. I'm Tim Moore. This is the podcast that talks with people who strive for excellence. Professor Wilfred Riley is a professor at Kentucky State University, in Kentucky, of course. He is a political scientist with a PhD and a law degree, and is a fine writer. He has written two books that I think every American should read, frankly, books that comfortably sit beside the books of some of my great intellectual heroes, people like Thomas Sowell and Heather McDonald and Shelby Steele. They're called Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War, published in 2019, and Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About, published this year to 2020. So go out and buy them now. Professor, it's a welcome to the podcast again. It's a great pleasure to have you on. I enjoyed immensely speaking with you last time, and I love everything you write. So after blowing all that smoke up your skirt, hello.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here once again. That's quite an effective intro, so I don't really have too much to add to that. Don't wear skirts too often, but glad to be back.
I didn't figure, but you don't know these days, Professor. Hey, listen, for our audience who did not hear the first podcast you and I did, why don't you provide an overview of each of your books and, you know, sort of either the 50,000-foot view. Take your time. There's no need to rush. But I think it's worth, you know, setting the stage, particularly for some of the questions I have for you moving on, to talk about Hate Crime Hoax and then to talk about Taboo, if you don't mind.
Not at all. So I would say that one of my core research interests, in addition to some wonky things in international politics, is looking at a lot of the very prominent claims that are made on the political left, on the political hard right. For example, the idea of universal white privilege, and seeing if there's any evidence for these in reality using modern empirical methods, linear, logistic, log-len, et cetera, regressions, massive in cross-tabulation, so on, actual scientific research. And very often I find that there's not much evidence of this kind. So the two books that you mentioned are both in that vein. Hate Crime Hoax takes a look at something that I think is obvious to a lot of people, and that's been regularly discussed in sort of edgy forms on the internet, but that really hadn't been researched at all, except for one piece by Laird Wilcox, in sort of the mainstream academic Republican intellectual space, which is the idea that a lot of these very high-profile race crime allegations that we've seen recently, Jussie Smollett, Covington Catholic, although that might be more of just an incident, Erica Thomas in the grocery store, Yasmin Saweed with the torn hijab, the burning of Hopewell Baptist, Duke LaCrosse alleged to be both a racial and an anti-feminist incident, you know, Drake University, Goucher College, Air Force Academy, where a general came in and gave a speech against racism, turn out not to be true. So for that book, I looked at more than 100 prominent cases of this, and using just standard research search terms on Google, Google Scholar, JSTOR, Bing, I put together what's currently a data set of about 680 case studies and 1,000 incidents of hate crime hoax, of situations where very prominent stories. One of my requirements for inclusion was a piece initially in the national media about racial or gender conflict simply turn out not to be true. I speculate in the book about the rate of hate crime hoaxing, which in some arenas like the college campus, I would put at or above 15%. I talk about why this is happening. Again, a very large number of these incidents take place in academia, in university, college, sometimes private high school campuses. So I look at sort of the woke culture that we're putting together in these environments. And that's Hate Crime Hoax, which has from time to time been an Amazon bestseller, which has attracted a lot of commentary. And I think one thing about the book is that whether or not you agree with my percentage estimates or, you know, an academic point of that kind, it's just undeniable there are 1,000 or so of these cases within a relatively short time frame. I mean, they're heavily clustered in the past 5 years. So the question is, what are we doing? One point I make in Hate Crime Hoax is almost an economic one, that the demand for bigotry seems to outweigh the supply. So on these pleasant, green, collegiate campuses, people are constantly told that they're surrounded by these new forms of bigotry, subtle racism and institutional prejudice, white privilege, cultural appropriation, stereotype threat. Please do tell me if I'm missing any. And in fact, there's very little evidence for this. So in many cases, you have student activists literally making up these incidents. This is what happened very famously at Keehan College. And then, for example, I'd put University of Missouri in this category. That's a chapter of the book.
Yeah.
But then rallying against the hate that they created. So that book looks at a social phenomenon in a period of time. I mean, the research period, probably 2016 to 18 for that. Just after the quote-unquote UMizzou scandal, during Yasmin Saeed, a little bit before Jussie, who's in the second edition. Taboo extends that idea of empirical analysis of touchy topics more broadly and really looks at 10 of the things you're not supposed to discuss. So, and this is across the board. I mean, I take on the, in my opinion, nutty, pure hereditarian alt-right in Chapter 10. I mean, I don't think there's much evidence for a lot of the far right's zanier claims either. If you're making an argument for the intellectual superiority of Caucasians, I mean, you'd have to understand that Caucasian is a haplotypic term that goes well beyond what we consider white. I mean, so why is Afghanistan or Moldova not performing on par with Germany? It doesn't make sense to make racialist arguments if the worst country in the world, quote unquote, and the best, Norway or Sweden, happen to be populated entirely by members of the same race. But with that said, the focus of the book is on, coming from the academic world myself, some of the claims made by the quote unquote postmodern or social justice left. So chapter one looks at the argument that there's an epidemic of brothers, African Americans, especially men, being killed by police. I find just very empirically, other people, by the way, Heather McDonald and so on, have also in journal articles, Wall Street Journal editorials, things of that level, found this. But I mean, in the most recent year on record, the total number of unarmed black men shot by the police was 14. So I break this down for a chapter. In a typical year, less than 1,200 people are killed by police. About 250 will be identified as African-American. That number, that percentage, 22.5% or whatnot, is a bit higher than our population percentage of 14%. But you have to adjust for the fact we have 1.9 to 2.4 times the white crime rate. I mean, this is really pretty simple method 306 stuff. There's no evidence for anything Black Lives Matter says. Chapter two looks at interracial crime more broadly. I find out first, digging into the BJS numbers, that violent crime involving blacks, whites, Asians fighting one another, attacking one another, is about 6% of all crime. I find out furthermore that it is, if you're looking at blacks and whites, about 80 to 85% black on white. That's not even surprising. They're five times as many whites. They have more money, yada, yada. But that's not the narrative that we see from CNN or MSNBC. And then I get into some deeper topics. I mean, I talk about the idea of white privilege. And at one point, I actually do, not the full version as of yet, but a small experiment where I give one of the standard privilege scales to a bunch of people. And I look at what affects their score on that metric. And with everything else adjusted for, race has about a 2 to 3 point impact. So, of course, there are some white racists. But, I mean, about 60 to 70% of privilege seems to just be social class. I mean, if you're a rich black guy on a typical 100-point scale, you might get a 69. A rich white guy, you might get a 71. But, I mean, a poor guy, you're going to get a 25. If you're asked questions like, do you know what frequent flyer miles are? Have you ever been attacked in a physical fight? Do you think your appearance would work against you in a job application setting? The poor guy is going to answer a lot more of those questions, yes, this is a problem, than any rich guy of any color. So, I mean, I discuss all of the things in life that could be seen as privileges: class, high IQ, attractive appearance, male sex, not being gay, I think fairly obviously a major one, at least for males, so on down the line. Cultural appropriation gets its own chapter. It's one of the silliest ideas ever conceived of by man. You know, I say, as I'm wearing a shirt made in China, you know, sitting at a desk on the old British model, so on down the line. And the final core of the book really attacks sort of this Ibram Kendi, Robin DiAngelo idea, which is that disparities equal discrimination. So I talk about, and Dr. Kendi, for example, says this fairly explicitly, that if you see a performance difference between two groups, i.e. blacks and whites on the SAT, The only two explanations for this are either, one, racism in some sort of intangible, hard-to-track form, or two, a genetic difference, what he calls a deep, permanent difference. We all know what he means. And I sort of say, well, this obviously isn't true. Quants and the social sciences, like Tom Sowell, the GOAT, and Amy Chua, John McWhorter, Fordham and Ogbu, Snyderman and Carmines. I mean, people for decades have noted that there are situational and cultural factors that differ between groups. And I hadn't seen much sort of public middle to upbrow writing about this. So I break down some of them. I mean, there's a chapter that looks at IQ. I think IQ differences are largely cultural. I mean, they're great books about why this occurs, 10,000 words, Tiger Mom, so on. But you can't deny that there are IQ and SAT differences among groups. And I find those predict a massive amount of differences in income. There's another chapter just on kind of the situational. I mean, the average black guy, the modal average black guy, the most common age for a black person, is 27. The equivalent for whites is 58. So obviously, if you're looking at anything from median income to crime rate to athletic performance, the 20-year-old guy is going to have a totally different personality profile than the 60-year-old guy, at least you'd hope. There's some incredible steroids on the market these days, I hear. But I mean, in general, those two individuals are going to be quite different. I talk about that. I talk about some of the things in culture, like amount of study time you can do to improve performance. But that's one of the drier sections of the book. I mean, the chapters most people comment on are police violence, interracial crime, white privilege, cultural appropriation, alt-right. But the entire book is looking at these ideas and seeing, is there any validity to them? And I'd actually, this upcoming year, I mean, I'm an associate professor and will go up for tenure as a full professor in a couple of years. So I want to get out some more peer-reviewed, solid journal articles. One of them something I'd like to do if I can get this published in sociology or political science is take an empirical look at whether whites are actually more fragile than anybody else. The author Robin DiAngelo has obviously written a best-selling book arguing for this idea of white fragility, that because of their, you know, privileged position in the intersectional hierarchy of vague racism and so on, all the terminology, whites rarely hear criticism and so are less able to discuss race than members of other groups, get angry, get affronted when race is brought up. I personally noticed just casually as an upper middle class citizen that whites are criticized constantly. And I mean, I think it would be interesting to actually work with a panel.
At least recently.
Yeah, I mean, for about 10 years now. I mean, there are pieces about this, the Great Awakening and so on. But I think it would be interesting to actually work with a panel to come up with what are the six or seven prominent stereotypes for each group, perhaps crime for African Americans, racism for whites, unearned wealth for whites, illegal immigration for Latinos. But ask people in these different populations with a couple of controls in place, you know, how do you feel when this thing is said about your group, when this thing is said to you? How would you react if you were accused of this? And I think what you'd obviously find is that most people object to a roughly equivalent degree to rude strangers telling them that their ethnic group is performing badly. I think white fragility will turn out to be another one of these ideas that's absolutely baseless. Just as in reality, privilege comes primarily from class, just as in reality, the number of people unprovokedly shot by cops in a year is 20, so on down the line. So that's what the books are, to some extent, taking, you know, solid B plus methods and modern scientific ideas and looking at this stuff on left and hard right that's creeping into the academy, but that's made a big impact on society, and saying, is there any evidence of this at all? And what I usually find is, no, there's not. I mean, going back to the first book, last sentence, I mean, there are less than 7,000 alleged hate crimes in a year, according to the FBI. Not all of them are against minorities. Whites are one of the fastest growing groups targeted. Jews are one of the largest groups targeted. Only 6% are successfully prosecuted. I've demonstrated that thousands are fakes. So it's important to have this level of understanding when you're listening to someone on either end of the spectrum just screaming about society.
You know, you said that the IQ chapter was the driest, but I thought it was a great chapter because I learned a lot of things that I did know. And it was also, you know, there's a kind of bravery in writing that chapter. After all, Charles Murray got singed down the third rail back in 1985 talking about IQ, right? But one of the things that jumped out of that chapter to me that I didn't know about IQ is, and you talked about Italian and Irish immigrants in the 30s and 40s and 20s, and the fact that their IQ tests back then had them at, you know, at very low levels, well below the norm, and over 30 or 40 years as they assimilated into a society, as their kids, you know, got into the middle class and into better schools and went to school longer, et cetera, et cetera, suddenly they got smarter. You know, the effect of things like the 10,000 hour rule, I've never really thought of that as an IQ enhancer. I think many of us think of IQ as something that's set when you're born, but you talk a lot in that chapter that IQ is something that you know, gets enhanced with work, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, so that's one of the things people do, and obviously, I mean, I assume that you, like me, have a pretty, you know, high G, actually, listening audience. If a psychometrician or something wants to get in touch and say, I think you got this article wrong, it's all well and good. But I mean, one of the things that I did notice is that we tend to think of, especially in my discipline, IQ as a set metric. That's simply not true. So in my own life, and this is so shocking to a lot of people on the hereditarian side, I'm frequently accused of lying about it. And I have screenshots of old test scores and so on. My IQ has gone from about 106 as a senior in a solid but hood, quote unquote, high school, to about 160 taking the Mensa boards, which I still do have a capture of in law school, to right now, last I took a test online, it was 142. And I mean, some of these tests like the Mensa scan, I mean, are, you know, that's not the same thing as going to your psychologist's office and doing the 3 hours with blocks and so on, but they're pretty on point. So at least within the context of those fallible exams, I mean, I've gone from, let's say, 110 to genius level to, you know, highly intelligent, but a bit down. And I can't help but thinking that I can't help but think that's because I'm not currently going to an elite law school. I don't spend 3 hours a day prepping for moot court and doing word games and getting ready for the one test of the year that's going to decide your professional career. So, I mean, this is an obvious point when you think about it. I was much more physically fit as a track runner in high school than I am today. So the idea that the mind can't develop in similar fashion, when you look at the research on neuroplasticity that's going on or epigenetics that's going on, is actually a fairly non-scientific idea. I think the hereditarians are a little behind the curve on some of that. And yeah, in the book, I mean, I note that this is, again, Tom Sowell. Tom Sowell in the 1980s was talking about this idea that the black IQ at the time was testing at 86. And this was being used as a basis for essentially racist claims on one side and for a great deal of shame within the black community. And Tom Sowell pointed out that's also the average IQ in Greece. You know, if you look at, now the Greeks have since improved, I believe they're 91, but so are black Americans actually. If you look at Dickens and Flynn, 2006, so on. But I mean, his point is that over time, IQs for groups change based on variables like the availability of school. You know, diet. Are you just eating potatoes? I don't mean to be glib about this, but we've changed a lot of things in the environment of the average Irishman or Greek since 1900. When he looks at the Army Alpha basic exams that were done during World War I, I believe it was Irish Americans, Italians, Slovenes, Greeks, Romanians, a couple other groups tested between 80 and 85. And all of those groups now test at the normal IQ for whites, which is 100 to 101. This is further complicated by the Flynn effect. So the average IQ has increased by about 15 points since around 1940, to the extent that we've made the IQ tests suffer. So if you look at what an Irish citizen would have scored on a modern IQ test based on what they did around World War I, it would be 69, something like that. It would functionally place them as developmentally delayed. Unless you think that the entire population of Ireland is retarded, I mean, being blunt, you have to acknowledge some plasticity or some mobility here. So I talk about that. But the second, and by the way, this is probably why I haven't gotten attacked as much as Murray. I mean, I'm mostly a culturalist on this topic. I'm also black. It's harder to call me a Nazi. But I'm...
Well, there's other names they can call you. They call Larry Elder and, you know, Clarence Carter those names, but we'll leave those aside.
People do send me the dancing raccoon meme on Twitter a lot. I guess the point is that I'm a coon. I mean, it's something I don't take really seriously. But, I mean, the second less PC part of the chapter where I say, okay, I'm a culturalist, this is why I think the Hereds are wrong, so on, I mean, that is pretty academic. But then I make the obvious point, but right now, the tested IQs are as they are, right? I mean, if you have an average IQ of 92, you're going to underperform a group with an average IQ of 99. So when you say in some of these fields, there are fewer, and it's not, blacks don't generally bring up the rear on some of the SAT on a year-by-year basis, for example. If you're looking at first-generation Latino immigrants, and you say there are fewer first-generation Latino immigrants getting PhDs in physics than there are Ashkenazi Jews, one question that you have to ask is, how are these people doing on the SAT, those two groups? You know, what about the GRE? What about the NAEP? And you see a very predictable gap that explains almost all of the gap in who gets those terminal degrees. So, and a bunch of other things, like IQ alone actually isn't entirely predictive if you're looking at black-white outcomes. You also have to, again, function in the fact that we're 10-plus years younger. African-Americans tend to live more in the South. Again, it has nothing to do with racism. That's where the boats landed. But, I mean, the wages in states like Mississippi are far lower for blacks and whites and are not very different across blacks and whites than they would be for either group in Manhattan. So if you're saying black people earn less, you have to look at where are African Americans living. And you might find that in urban Arkansas, there's virtually no difference between blacks and whites, but there are more blacks in urban Arkansas. You're going to find a lot of black people in Jackson, Little Rock, Tallahassee, so on. And you're going to find fewer in Spokane, Washington, or a higher income environment like this. That also explains why Asians out-earn whites, by the way. The 120K to 65K gap between Indian American and white households isn't explained by a 3 or 4 point gap in tested IQ. You also have to look at, I mean, are these primarily tech workers that live in downtown San Francisco? So again, these sort of basic multivariate analyses, and I mean, well done ones, but the sort of thing you'd see in any scientific paper, take apart a lot of the ideas in quote unquote woke science, which has kind of been allowed to exist in its own disciplinary carve outs, the ethnic studies and so on, but which becomes a problem when it starts influencing mainstream society. If the majority of people,
But
that's pretty much it for this point. I mean, if the majority of people believe with Dr. Kendi that the two options on performance are either genetic difference or racism, people are going to be faced with the, well, interestingly, people are going to be faced with two options about how to be a racist. Either you can accept that your group is so racist, it's causing the underperformance of these other groups, or you can say, well, I guess I'm a racist because I'm not going to accept this slur on my people. I think there's a genetic difference. And what I'm saying is you might want to look at the fact that this guy is 30 years younger than this other guy and spends half as much time studying for the test. Whether or not there are some 2 and 3% genetic differences, that is the huge, huge majority of what's going on.
Yes. You wrote a couple of articles recently that I read, one in Spiked Online and one I think you sent to me from Real Clear Public Affairs. And the one in Spiked Online was titled Michael Brown, The Founding Myth of Black Lives Matter. It's subtitled A Fact-Free Narrative of Racially Motivated Police Violence. But interestingly, you started that article talking about Michael Brown obliquely, and then you go directly to him. But obliquely, I mean that you talked about Amazon banning Shelby Steele and Eli Steele's documentary, What Killed Michael Brown. Talk a little bit about that, and particularly, you know, I don't understand. I mean, maybe I'm stupid, you know, or maybe I don't think I'm naive, but maybe I am. But I don't understand why people want to ban stuff by such well-respected people like Dr. Steele, who've written, you know, great books and et cetera, et cetera. But talk about that and talk about that banning as well.
Yeah, so I think that the banning itself is part of something, a part of a very important negative trend that we're seeing in sort of new media right now. The idea, and I will say as a computer guy, as someone, I certainly wouldn't describe myself as a hacker, but as someone, I teach cybersecurity at a state university. I mean, I had a lot of friends that were at least at the script kiddie level back when people thought they were going to grow up to be cyberpunks and so on. I've always enjoyed the internet. I mean, and there is an internet world out there with Reddit and 4chan, if that's your thing, and all these conversational sites, the science debate blogs and so on, perhaps at my end. But I mean, the whole idea of the internet was that it was kind of the Wild West of information.
Right.
People right. would police you if you started posting terror plots or child pornography to a thread. You don't want your platform shut down, and all that stuff's disgusting. But in general, you could say what you wanted on the internet. You had an anonymous avatar, and people who were generally pretty intelligent could discuss this in an open forum. And with the consolidation of the tech giants, which is a term that would have sounded absurd in the message board era, by the way, Facebook and Twitter and so on, the right-wing responses like Parler, Google controls something like 95% of America's access to information. We've seen that dramatically change in very disturbing ways. You don't need to burn the books anymore. So there are a couple examples that come obviously to mind. First, there are some fringe examples that I think are pretty important. I mean, there's a recent documentary called The Trayvon Hoax that was produced by a right-wing guy. I mean, certainly an edgy guy, but also someone who did probably the best known of the recent Beatles documentaries. And this was something he essentially alleged that using a great deal of evidence, which you can get from him if you contact him and ask, prove this. He alleged that the attorney in Trayvon Martin's case, Ben Crump, essentially put a fake witness on the stand claiming to be Trayvon Martin's girlfriend and saying some essentially false things about the fight between Martin and Zimmerman that led to the arrest of Zimmerman. Now, you can agree or disagree about whether this seems plausible to you, but it is backed up by information the filmmaker will give you. I mean, this is something that was in the top 1,000 or so releases on Amazon for quite a while. It's something I've never once seen discussed in a public mass media article, and it's something that many people have said on my page is problematic or difficult just to upload to, for example, Twitter or Facebook. Again, that's just a minor example. But should this guy, Joel Gilbert, be correct, and Glenn Lowry, John McWhorter, serious people have discussed this in the academic world, that says some fascinating, critically important things about the founding narrative for Black Lives Matter. But you can't really discuss it. It's gone. And that's just one little case. But you've been seeing this more and more often. The Hunter Biden story is the classic example of this. The Hunter Biden story is real. I think it's stupid. I don't care if the vice president's kid had a cocaine problem, but the video of Hunter Biden involved in very explicit sex acts while smoking crack was on GTV for a while. It's not my thing to watch, but I have friends that have seen it. The uploaded images from that became memes on Reddit. This is a thing that happened that everyone in internet culture knows happened. And there's an incredible backstory to this. I mean, the New York Post is a right-leaning but reputable newspaper, top 10 newspaper in the country. They stand by their coverage. Fox News, about in that same category, vetted through the whole thing. Bobulinski went on Fox for an interview. Biden never denied any of this. Social media simply decided that this story was sketchy and right before an election that they wouldn't allow coverage of it. So if you attempted to post a link to the New York Post story, again, a front page story in a top 10 or top 12 newspaper of record, your account was shut down. My fiance, my partner, had her account shut down for a day until she deleted the tweet. The New York Post didn't delete the tweet. They had their account shut down for 3 weeks. That is the prevention of probably 50 million contacts with the newspaper. The press secretary for the United States president had her account shut down. So we're seeing more and more of this kind of thing. I mean, my own bias is kind of center-right, but nothing I'm saying is even contested. I mean, you can see Bobulinski's testimony on FoxNews.com. This is real stuff that happened that the right-wing media covered quite professionally. So that's another example. We're kind of ascending the ladder here. The Who Killed Michael Brown thing, I think, is the ultimate example of this that I've seen recently, in that Shelby Steele is, again, conservative, but a top American intellectual. I mean,
undoubtedly.
Yeah, he wrote White Guilt, Hoover Institute level guy. This isn't disputed at all. He and, I believe, his eldest son put together a documentary looking at what actually happened in the Mike Brown case. And again, the Michael Brown narrative is one of the founding baseline narratives of Black Lives Matter. Most of the BLM chants, like hands up, don't shoot, come specifically from the Michael Brown case. So the street narrative of this that even I have heard as a younger African-American male is this innocent black boy got into an argument with a cop, but then tried to surrender, walking away, probably back turned, hands up in the air. That murderous white man shot him for no reason. Then they left his body in the street like a dog. And as Shelby Steele demonstrates, what actually happened is very, very different. The Obama administration's Department of Justice, which doesn't lean right, cleared Officer Darren Wilson on multiple counts for multiple reasons for the killing of Michael Brown. I mean, Michael Brown's DNA was found on the slide and trigger guard of Wilson's gun. It was found on the inside door handle of his police car. Wilson eventually got out. There was a physical fight. That's when the shooting happened. But I mean, both these guys, Michael Brown was not a small teenager. He was 6'6". Wilson was 6'5". This is a public street fight between two big men, one going for the other's gun. So this movie makes all these points. And while nothing in the film has been challenged in terms of accuracy, Amazon opted not to allow the movie to be distributed or streamed through any of its platforms because it said that it didn't meet their standards of quality or some such. And there was enough noise raised about this because people know who Shelby Steele is, that eventually the movie was made available. When I downloaded it, there was a warning disclaimer of some kind on it, as I recall. Now there's not, I will say. But I mean, I wrote a piece about this where I said, we obviously all oppose police brutality, which is, again, something, there are nonsensical narratives on the left, and for that matter, the hard right, too. You know, blacks are attacking us at every moment about street violence. The reality is that almost everyone opposes crime. Almost everyone opposes police brutality. But the BLM cases are largely very poor examples of police brutality. To the extent that people might find themselves asking, is this all they've got? Hakeem Littleton, the guy who started the Detroit riots, was literally in a gunfight with a cop when he got shot. And he had his own gun out. He'd fired several times. Even the tragic cases, Breonna Taylor, for example, should not have died. But Breonna Taylor was killed because her boyfriend fired a shot at a group of police officers who had apparently announced themselves as police officers, and they returned fire. So the point of the piece is, one, these cases aren't what we've been told, but also there's massive media malfeasance here in not telling us this, in not telling us that Breonna Taylor's ex-boyfriend was one of the largest drug dealers in the Louisville area. The police had a sworn warrant for Breonna Taylor's residence. When they arrived, her current boyfriend shot at them, almost crippled one of them, by the way, hit one of them in the leg, intensive care for at least a day. I mean, serious injury. You know, so that is not discussed, and it should be. That's the point of the piece.
But speaking of fragility, but this in this case, fragility of a different kind, what is it about these folk, Professor, that they're so fragile that they have to suppress these stories? I mean, look, do they believe that their narrative is so frail that it can't stand up to scrutiny? I mean, after all, I don't know about you, but I'm not losing any sleep over the fact that there are silly books like White Fragility and Kendi's anti-racism book. It's okay. I mean, you know, life will go on, and I know what I believe, and that's fine. But you know, we're not banning fact-free work. So why does the left feel that they have to ban the works of people, you know, like Steele? I mean, it's one thing to ban Alex Jones, I guess, but Steele, I don't get it. I mean, is it just a power play? Is that why I don't get it? What really motivates here? What's the genesis reason for all this?
I think that it gets into, I do think this gets into questions of power. I mean, most people on the political left, to a much greater extent than people on the political right. I mean, thinking of my own kind of business center-right space, I mean, what would I change dramatically about America? Lower taxes, perhaps a few more restrictions on late-term abortion, less foreign intervention, but I mean, it would be essentially the same country. I think that many on the left want a dramatically different country. I mean, and there is polling data from Rasmussen, Zogby, so on that indicates this, that if you ask people, would you like the USA to be a largely disarmed, more socialist, majority-minority country by, say, 2050, leftists are very likely to say yes. And except for majority-minority, maybe, but it's not really an issue either way for me, but I mean, America seems to be working pretty well now. But I would say emphatically no to that. There are many people that want that. There are many people that have that goal. And I think that the current narrative of the police are evil, education is evil, so on, ties into achievement of that goal. I also think that by this point, there's a considerable financial incentive tied into some of these programs. Again, I'm a political science quant rather than an econometrician, but you can't not see it. I mean, the counterpoint to the argument of white privilege is that, in fact, we've had institutional affirmative action in the USA since 1967. I certainly don't think my white buddies are oppressed, but I'll just say it was not a disadvantage being black when I applied to elite law schools. Only a fool could believe this to be the case. So we have these programs at every major institution. There are people that are in the HR, diversity, DIE, whatever you might call it, office, some of them doing quite a good job, some of them the equivalent of grifting. You know, you have extensive minority set-asides in business. It would probably be no exaggeration to say that $1 in every 12 interacts with one of these programs. You have, yeah, maybe one in every 10. I mean, when you consider the percentage of minority executives, so on. You know, and you have beyond that the large activist organizations. I mean, I always note that the Southern Poverty Law Center's endowment is $470 million well invested. That's more than the state university I teach at. It puts you a bit outside the Fortune 500, but certainly Fortune 1000 as a business, especially if we're talking profit, if we're talking net. I mean, I don't imagine they have many expenses. You know, they go to court on behalf of a couple of sympathetic clients every year. I mean, other than that, you're sort of taking that money in. You know, so all of that depends on this narrative. So I think that there are people that want to change society and that are doing fairly well. Sean King comes to mind in contemporary society. And there's a narrative underlying that. And yes, I do think a lot of that narrative is quite weak. If you look at the reality of police violence, if you look at the reality of interracial crime, if you look at the reality of the effect of age, region, IQ, study time, so on success, i.e. income, the reality of white privilege where class has 10 times the effect, so on down the line, there's not much evidence for these things. Then I've actually read the literature pretty extensively here. I mean, there are some interesting niche pieces in sociology. And by niche, I don't mean that the author is not well known, but looking at one element of a system and finding racism. Pager, for example, in 2002 looked at, I believe the breakdown would be hiring for non-affirmative action, white-owned private sector employers in Milwaukee, and found that you were significantly more likely to get a callback if you were white than if you were black. So, I mean, in that arena, in the Midwestern cities now, a couple of decades ago, did that exist? Maybe. But, I mean, the flip side to that is that if you looked at public sector hiring, or hiring for the 25% of companies that are now POC-owned, don't forget that, or hiring in affirmative action Fortune 500 companies, you'd find the exact reverse effect. So in general, when you take this stuff at sort of a broad level, Tom Sol, for example, found that incomes for white, black, and Asian men with the same qualifications had been the same since 1969. When you look at those, and I have no doubt that's true, I have no doubt that a black guy with an 1100 SAT might apply to a black business first, or, you know, apply for a job with the government or start a company. I have no doubt those three guys would wind up in the same place. So when you take a look at these broad facts, they do tend to debunk a lot of the kind of establishment center left narrative. And that can't necessarily be allowed because that ties into a lot of future goals and it ties into a lot of present money. Think about, and I'm a long talker, so I'll shut up after this, but think about what actually...
No, it's fine. You just talk as much as you want.
Fair enough. But no, I mean, think about what getting rid of affirmative action would do to higher education. I can't even say, if you're not also talking about getting rid of legacy programs for whites and so on, you know, athletic scholarships, I'm not even sure what my position on that would be. But think about the impact. What percentage of, unless you made this retroactive, I suppose you would, but what percentage of students would not have been admitted to the university that are currently there? What would the demographics of the place look like going forward? How many people would have to be fired? At a typical big state, I'd say 70. I mean, this would be a massive, impactful change. So people are resisting that change. And I mean, it's just putting this in woke, you know, wokies will hate this comparison, but think about this in any other context. I mean, prior to 1950, there was an entire body of science you know, phrenology and the race research of the time and the studies in the military about the fights and integrated units and so on that argued that people just couldn't get along. We couldn't integrate. This is probably the majority position. And people who had just seen Black, Irish, Italian, so on, Chicagoans getting on buses together, or people who had a moral interest in this question, or quite serious quant researchers like Clark, did their own work, came to their own conclusions and said, no, this paradigm is wrong. And I think that now, after 60 years of institutional affirmative action, we're probably approaching the this paradigm is wrong point in the other direction. There's no way. So, for example, one final figure, whether or not you think that Black overrepresentation in this field is due to racism, and I don't, I think it's due to a slightly but definitely higher crime rate, sometimes 250% as high as the white rate. But it's undisputed that about 80% of the people shot by police just aren't Black. That out of 999 in the WAPO database for last year, a small number were unidentified, and I believe 749 were identified as Caucasian, whites, or Hispanics. Okay, virtually no Asians, by the way. Who knows why? But I mean, those cases, that 80% majority of the caseload of individuals shot by police doesn't receive 80% or 40% of the coverage in the mass media of this issue. The 80% of cases receive about 10% of the coverage. You can do a crude test of this just by Googling well-known police shooting. When I most recently did this with all cookies deleted, I found 2 Hispanic cases, 3 white cases, and 36 Black cases. So, I mean, I guess the point is there obviously is an attempt to defend the narrative because of how it benefits people, but the narrative itself is weak. If you allowed a full-on challenge, if you put someone who argued that racism is the cause of every problem up against a Thomas Sowell-style culturalist, or a traditional Black conservative, or even an IQ hereditarian, if you just had those two incorrect positions going at it, they would get slaughtered. And I think that this is why people that take that position, the Kendys and so on, never debate. My buddy Coleman Hughes has a standing offer to Kendi to debate for like $100,000
for charity. That's a really good point. Boy, I hadn't, you know, that's, I knew that, but I'd forgotten. That's a really good point. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I wanted to put a coda on that. Yeah, absolutely.
Coleman's got to go fund me and everything. I mean, I did pretty well in business. I thought about doing this myself, asking, and this would be sort of an epic troll. You know, what happens if Kendi doesn't debate? Would I keep the money? Let's not talk about that. Probably not, actually. I'd give it to charity. But I mean, I've thought about asking some of my business contacts, people that have given institutional gifts to K-State, you know, look, I'll owe you a favor in my sector. Would you be willing to give $10,000 to this fund and we'll challenge someone like Kendi? And I mean, I don't really see how he could say no if you had $100,000 set up and this would go to his favorite charity or something. But I mean, I would bet you, I don't think he'd debate me. I think that much less, you know, someone even more veteran, Tom Sowell, Glenn Lowry. He said no to Lowry as well. But I mean, I think that the response would be something like, I won't be bribed into participating in a white supremacist praxis like a formal debate with a white adjacent individual such as yourself. You know, Coleman is Black and Puerto Rican, speaks, I think, 3 languages. It doesn't matter. It's a white man. You know?
Yeah, and that's a great answer. You know, you really hit on something that is important. This, two things, really. One is that these are business decisions at some level, because, you know, even great movements in history turn out to end up being businesses over time. You know, it's almost like Reagan's comment about federal programs and mortality. There's money there, there's jobs there, and people need to protect those. And also that protecting the fragility of the argument. And I think that's spot on, because you just don't have to dig very much to realize how dumb this stuff is. I mean, for instance, you know, you wrote an article also, Why Woke History is Not the Answer, you know, and you know, very carefully and clearly lay out the fallacies of the 1619 Project. But I always think to myself, first of all, why do you have to invent history? Isn't history miserable enough in and of itself? I mean, really, when you look back on history, we've had slavery since there were humans. Oh, and by the way, if you really cared so much about slavery as an issue,
Maybe you talk about slavery in, I don't know, you know, Western China. Maybe you talk about slavery in Dubai, West Africa still. I mean, maybe you talk about something that you could change. And so you have to ask yourself, I think, very easily, that this is just all games for power and money. And I think you're right about that. You can comment on my editorialization if you'd like.
No, yeah. I mean, I think that so the woke I think that the reason so the opening line from that particular piece was the USA may be the first society, at least successful society, to create a noble lie about her past that makes that past seem worse, not better than it was. So, I mean, an example of this would be the comment, slavery lasted 400 years. No, it didn't. The United States began in 1776. We had chattel slavery until 1865. Then it was fully abolished by a bloody war that caused 650,000 deaths. And we moved forward. I mean, now, obviously, Reconstruction was followed by Jim Crow, but it was also followed by the Great Migration of African Americans to the North, by the Harlem Renaissance, so on. Many northern states were integrated outside of restrictive covenants by the early 1930s. So, I mean, all of that is a very different story from what 1619 is telling, which is sort of endless, grinding, racial abuse, rather than middle class, segregated, of course, but functional black neighborhoods, rather than what you would actually have seen in Harlem or Chicago in the 1940s. And I think that there's a reason to go with the darker story as versus the more positive one. Simply put, the more positive story includes recognition of the fact that African Americans have suffered dramatically, but it also includes recognition of the fact that everybody has suffered, many groups to nearly equivalent degrees, and what we need now is a shared civic identity. So, I mean, for example, I was recently reading Time on the Cross, one of the great books about slavery. And the authors obviously aren't fans of slavery, because nobody is. But they are skilled empirical scientists, and they make the point that the horrors of slavery, while horrible, I'm going to keep saying how horrible these horrors were mirrored by nearly equivalent horrors around the world. The potato famine in Ireland, the abuse of the immigrant industrial class in the northern cities, so on down the line. And there's an unforgettable graph in the book where they look at average life expectancy, white, free, and I thought it's interesting they said both white and free. We still had bond servants at this time, but 40. Average U.S. life expectancy, slave, 36. And then the chart trended down through all these other life expectancies, like average life expectancy, Irishman in Ireland, I believe it's 31. Average life expectancy in a major city, London, New York, Philadelphia, 24. The reality is that, of course, no one endorses slavery or, for that matter, chasing Irishmen to their post in the machine shop with whips. But history was pretty terrible for most people. For most of history, your options were basically farmer, lord of farmers, and there was only one of those, or struggling mercenary soldier. As a woman, you could add abused wife to that list. But, I mean, that's what most people were. And if you said that to an audience of people, most people would say, well, blacks had it a bit worse. Maybe we should consider 5 years of affirmative action or something. But thank God we don't live in that time anymore, any of us. And I don't think that's the message that, say, 1619 wants to convey. That actually is an accurate message that I would want to convey. Let's remember our history, learn from it, and move on. But that doesn't justify the endless continuation of some of these programs we've discussed. And it also doesn't justify a wholly unique status for African Americans. I mean, after all, Native American Indians were the victims of genocide in this country, or at least attempted genocide. Neither side really knew enough about disease germs and so on to make that stick at the time. But I mean, you know, we conquered a fourth of Mexico. And it's not even as though this were an evil act on the part of the USA. The Mexicans, in my take, started the war. But I mean, history is full of incidents like this. Women couldn't vote until 1920. So just that point, hey, this sucked for everybody, now we're all rich, that doesn't really convey any kind of utile information. So what 1619 tries to do very explicitly, and this isn't my kind of right-leaning, cocky take, this is what they say, is link virtually everything in modern American life to obscure traditions in slavery or lost race wars or something of this kind hundreds of years ago. So we eat so much sugar because that's what the slaves grew. That's an actual article. There is a piece in the full project called How Segregation Caused Your Traffic Jam. arguing that these separations of cities into white and poor white and black, perhaps native areas, is what makes the U.S. highway system so inefficient. There are a couple of responses. For example, why is there equal traffic congestion in the north? I actually bothered to check this out. Google has great mobility data. But that's the point of 1619, that everything that exists now comes from slavery. And so what we need to do is change everything that exists now. How can we continue this slave-based healthcare system? That sort of thing. And I think this is basically crap. I mean, the traffic question that I phrased literally does come from congestion and mobility data. You can find that online by Googling it. You know, so is this true? Not really. Is it popular? Yes.
Yeah, I have had the joy of interviewing twice now, probably America's finest living historian of the American experience, H.W. Brands at UT, University of Texas. And he said to me in last week's podcast, it airs tomorrow, he said, you know, I have to keep reminding my students that history is really, really complicated. And then when you peel the onion, it gets even more complicated. And then you peel it again, it gets even more complicated. You know, it's like life. And these one-note books and articles don't seem to understand that basic question. They also never ask the question as compared to what you've hinted at through your answer. I want to turn to some interesting statistics to come out of this election. And I don't want to keep you all day. I appreciate your time. But I thought for sure you'd have something to say about some of these stats. Trump got at least 19% of the black male vote, doubling the black male vote. And by the way, 8% was pretty damn high in 2016. I think he's going to end up with 9 or 10% of the black female vote. Although we do know in Florida, in the Ron DeSantis election 2 years ago, I think that DeSantis got something like 25% of the black female vote because of his support of charter schools. Trump got, it looks like something like 40% of the Hispanic vote. Here in Texas, along the border of all places, in counties that are 96% Hispanic, Mexican American, I should be more specific, he got over 50% of the vote. And this was true down ticket as well. And his support amongst white males went from plus 31 to plus 23. So is it possible that the great racist struck a chord in minorities and over the last 4 years and didn't strike a strong accord against with white people? What's going on there? And is it sustainable in your view?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, Trump's not a racist. I may take some heat for saying that. He said some stupid stuff on Twitter, but I can't think of a single anti-black, hardcore, not dog whistle potentially, but racist comment Trump has made. I don't think that illegal immigrants, for example, are a race. And I bother to bring this up because Donald Trump, I'm a hip-hop guy. I grew up, hip-hop and internet were two of my tribes as a younger man 10, 15 years ago. And Donald Trump was one of the most popular figures in hip-hop culture. There's a line in a song by the rapper Nelly, Bill Gates, Donald Trump, hold the door there, where he's talking about how he wants to be wealthy like these men, both of whom he later mentioned as a young businessman he tried to reach out to, he tried to contact. Donald Trump was the guest of honor at a Comedy Central roast hosted by Snoop Dogg in, I think, 2014. So this idea that not this is a guy who said a couple cocky, stupid things, but that this guy is a Klansman, this would have struck almost anyone as absolutely ridiculous up until the day before Donald Trump announced he was running for president as a Republican. So I want to note that. And yeah, Trump did well among minorities. Your figures are correct. He got just under 20% of black males, probably about 40% of Hispanics when all ballots are counted. I'd imagine he won Asians. Asians are part of a combo category other. So he won 37% of other. Unless he did extraordinarily well among Samoans or Native Americans or something like that, I would assume that came from the Asian business class vote. And this led to some crazy reactions on the left. Nicole Hannah-Jones, who I've sparred with a couple times on Twitter from 1619, posted this comment. What this says to me is that white supremacy is flexible and more people are being accepted as white. And I responded and said, well, in what sense is white supremacy a meaningful term if that category includes all Asians, the black middle class, and 40% of Latinos. And she didn't respond. She blocked me, actually. But I mean, that's a valid point. There's the idea of, unless you're using this Brazilian style as a crude proxy for race or for class, you know, you're no longer a Hutu. You know, defining whites as including Asians, well-off black people, and most Mexican Americans is just meaningless. So that occurred. Major reaction on the left. I'm not extraordinarily surprised by that, actually. I'm not surprised it was Trump that got that percentage of the vote either. One of the things that a lot of people on Twitter, if you know what I'm talking about, young millennial knowledge workers, don't seem to understand is that the upper middle class standard of discourse is shared by very, very few people. So I play pickup basketball, and virtually every time I play, I'm called, you know, white boy because I have light skin, you know, my N-word if I throw a good pass, you know, MF-er, like the sort of things people say during pickup sports. I use some of these terms as well, although obviously never a racial insult, you know, but it's impossible to imagine anyone guarding me, black, standard, Caucasian, Italian, American, being offended by most of the things Trump or Biden says. So there's a huge element of nodding along and pretending to clutch your pearls when people talk about Trump's racism, just as there would have been among well-bred women if they were talked to about female orgasms in 1920. It's the current taboo. Oh, no, I've heard about that, but I've never experienced it. You know, that is what you're seeing. And in reality, I think most people understand, one, most of Trump's comments are taken out of context by the media. One of the most misleading stories I've ever seen was Trump calls group of Hispanics animals. And I was genuinely offended by that. Did he really? Did he cross the line? So I opened it, and the group of Hispanics was MS-13.
Right.
I believe this was a New York
Times. Pretty accurate, seems to me like.
Yeah, but I believe this was a New York Times back page piece. Right. This isn't something I'm making up or exaggerating. And it just struck me as sort of the epitome of how to lie with phraseology. Like, I guess MS-13 is a group of Hispanics. You know, like Al-Qaeda is a group of Arab individuals of Arabian descent, you know, but so that's an element of surrounding a lot of Trump's nonsense online. A secondary point is that Joe Biden and many Democratic officials, by the way, specifically many black elected officials, have said very similar things. The heuristic just doesn't brand them as racist. So Biden, for example, I mean, called one of the country's probably top 30 black journalists a junkie, or asked him if he was a junkie. For asking if Biden had taken a cognitive test. He mentioned that segregationists, quote unquote, got things done working with him in the Senate. He said that poor kids can be just as smart as white kids. He said that if you don't vote for him, you ain't black in a fake black accent. He said that Mitt Romney's going to put y'all back in chains at a campaign rally. His kids shouldn't have to live in a racial jungle. Just on and on and on with this nonsense, never called out for it. And this is at the same level as Canada's hyper woke PM being recorded in blackface like three different times. At one point, he dyed his whole body dark brown and went to a party as Aladdin. And this is like 1995. I mean, people had to have told him about this. You know, so I think many people recognize those two points, and I also think many people just don't care very much. If someone says Haiti's kind of a crappy country. If Haiti is sending a large number of refugees here, insults us as a trade deal or something, the large majority of Americans would probably say, well, that's a bit rude, but I mean, it is near the bottom of the global pack in GDP, up there in violence. You know, so again, similarly, the fine people on both sides thing was just nonsense that Trump did not in that form say. But I mean, he did say both groups, quote unquote, Antifa fighters and neo-Nazis were very bad. He took some heat for that. You know, you're equivocating. You're saying this is a two-sided problem. Again, I think the large majority of Americans would say that actual black bloc Antifa fighters and actual neo-Nazis are both scumbags. I don't think that's a minority position. What I'm getting at with all this is that I don't think most black or Asian business people were offended at all by Trump. I think they looked at actual policies like enterprise zones, charter schools, cutting regulation, the platinum plan, and said, okay, that sounds as good to me as what Joe Biden's offering. The reason that...
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, go on. Please.
No, I think you're spot on that he would be the person to appeal to ethnic minorities in ways that others hadn't, other Republicans hadn't. Anyone who spent any time around New York, and I spent most of my life around New York, and knew anything about Donald Trump, knew that he spent an awful lot of time on the, you know, on his construction sites. And who is on construction sites? You know, people of all ethnicities who all talk like you just described before, mm-hmm. who appreciate someone who's direct and forward. And by the way, in a place like New York where you have to bump into people, you bump into all kinds of people all the time. And if you didn't learn how to live with them, it'd be a miserable life, wouldn't it? So, I mean, a guy from New York, really a street guy, because that's, even though he's a billionaire, he was a street guy. He would have a message, I think, that normal people would gravitate to. And I also think, and I'd like your comments on this, that, you know, the Dems tend to think about all of us as ethnic entities, but he thought about people in a classed way. And his view, it seems to me, it was, hey, I don't, you know, if you're at the bottom of the rung, if you're one of those deplorables, if you're one of those people, you know, whose jobs got shifted to China, to use his phrase, if you're one of those people that the Joe Bidens and then the Hillary Clintons and the Never Trump Republicans forgot and think are crude, and no matter what your color, I'm for you. Oh, and by the way, I don't like those pointy-headed people that live, and I know you don't either. And I live in a place, and you do too, which isn't homogenous like the two coasts are, where you meet all kinds of different people, and you meet an awful lot of people who are fed up with the pointy-headed people. And I think he struck that nerve. And the question is, one, do you agree? And two, is it sustainable? I mean, never underestimate the capacity for Republicans to blow an opportunity going forward.
Yeah, I think it's sustainable if the GOP sustains it. So, I mean, the parties have moved over time. I mean, one of the things people forget is that the majority of it, you know, at least employed, tax-paying, black, native, et cetera, citizens would probably have been Republicans until the late 1960s. The GOP was considered the strong on defense party, party of the small businessman. The Democrats were more the party of the unions. Many of the unions had a history of discrimination against minorities, including well-qualified minority men. So the shift to the Democratic Party began with first the reality, which wasn't all that extraordinary, and then the presentation of this story of the Southern strategy, i.e. Reagan appealed to working-class whites by doing things that were considered racist. Some of them may have been, the majority of them weren't, but the media certainly presented them that way. There were a series of, you know, appealing often Southern Democratic candidates from Carter to Clinton. And you saw a shift of African-Americans from the GOP to the Democrats. There's no reason that couldn't happen again. In fact, one of the things you've seen over the past couple of years. Now, I actually I had my questions about this, not calling anyone a grifter or anything like this. But when I saw Blexit begin and the MAGA challenge and so on, as a serious academic pundit role aside, I mean, my question was, what are you guys doing? Like, how much money have these movements raised? What's the black vote going to look like? But when you see the black vote 20% for Trump, like, okay, I'm sure you guys made some money, but you definitely, those giant rallies and so on apparently had an effect. So you have seen a major attempt by the Republicans to reach out to minorities. I mean, if you're talking about something like one, the Asian category, 20% of the black vote, I mean, it's successful. And yeah, hopefully that continues. One of the things that is extremely weird, and this, by the way, is why the hard left focuses on racism so much. They don't have much else with this demographic. But one of the things that's extremely weird is the cultural conservatism of blacks and Hispanics. I mean, devout Baptists and Catholics, military service people, varsity athletes, you know, so on down the line. Not as likely to get married anymore, which is probably the biggest problem in the black community. But, you know, in terms of everything else, you're looking at pretty conservative voters, transgender issues. When I talk about this stuff with my black buddies, they don't even know what I'm talking about. And it's actually a good reminder of what the mainstream science-based position on this stuff kind of is. So if I say, you know, a transgender individual, someone who's biologically male, but who believes they are a woman, I mean, a buddy of mine from the old neighborhood, black or for that matter, Irish American, whatever, is probably going to say, man, that's a dude. Like, what? And it's just going to be this funny conversation. Like, well, no, they have
a few choice words thrown in just for good measure, right?
No, like, if you were, like, the whole conversation, like, well, you have to understand they have a mild mental illness that makes them believe that they are female, and many people respect this. But, man, I mean, I might say, you know, your name is whatever, but that individual's a man. And it's just, it is, that's the take on this in every working class neighborhood in the country. So, I mean, if the Republicans appeal to, and not being abusive to trans people or anything, but if the Republicans appeal to these obvious points, like Joe Biden, for example, during one of his campaign stops was asked by an 8-year-old kid, if I believe I'm female, would you allow me to transition fully, hormones, all of it? And Biden said, yes, of course. And this follows, and you can look this up, this isn't me exaggerating at all, this follows in the footsteps of Elizabeth Warren, who said she was going to pick her Secretary of Health and Human Services by having a 5th grade trans kid select them. Which, by the way, is how I'm going to do everything in life from now on. Who to marry? Will it be Jane? What's the new car looking like? Where should I buy a house? 5th grade trans kid. That's who makes the big decisions. I mean, but like when people hear this kind of crazy crap, I think that it's very easy to generate a backlash. And I think the Republicans should do that. But the Republicans have an easy pitch that's available to them right now, by the way. We're the party of normal people that like America.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you
well put, very well put. You know, I've been saying that to my kids for years, and glad to hear someone other than myself say it, someone I respect. Yeah, I think it's a very, very good point. And why not just say it the way you just said it?
Yeah, I think it's so. By the way, the great thing about that pitch, which I give to the GOP for free, but the great thing about that is it distinguishes them from both the alt-right, the extreme right, fringe right, whatever they're calling themselves right now, edgelord right. Because those guys, they say some things about immigration and so on that may even contain kernels of truth, but their basic point is that they don't like America. They want to break away to an all-white ethno-state that somehow borders both the ocean and the heartland. And when you listen to this stuff for more than an hour, for more than a couple of minutes online, it's just sort of like, well, that's fantasy. You know, I agree on merit immigration, but that's it. Other than that, this is useless. So the point I'm making would separate that on one side. But on the other hand, you would paint the left as what it is to some extent, which is an elitist alliance between the upper class and the lower class, designed to unify people that feel that they are outsiders, that they are better than the mainstream of Americans, or that they are victimized here. Against that, the GOP pitch would be, we're the normal taxpayers. We want slightly lower taxes. We don't want major foreign wars. We don't support anything crazy. We think the
reason. We want good schools. Bada boom, bada bang. Yeah.
Yeah. Charter schools are possible. All that. Yeah. That would be a winning pitch for the Republicans, and that would attract many minorities. The only, and a lot of Republican candidates, a bit too elitist, but solid candidates like John McCain, the only reason that didn't work is the extreme effectiveness of the dubious allegations of racism. I mean, essentially, the primary Democratic argument against the GOP is those people are racist Nazis. And I think this is becoming less effective because it reached such frenzied levels of screaming and shrieking under Trump. At the same time, he was doing things like meeting with Kanye West and Lil Wayne, that a lot of people just started tuning it out. I mean, that's what I'm seeing in middle-class minority communities. It's, you know, you might think the guy's a little prejudiced, but it's the shouting this over and over 100 times a day, no one really falls for.
Well, you mentioned before we got started that you're going to have, you know, pending in a little while, some time on your hands, and you got some projects you want to work on. Anything you want to talk about to a general audience, or are you more focused on academic things with tenure coming up soon?
Well, there actually are a number of academic articles that I want to write that I'm thinking about formatting now. I mean, like, one would be a full-on through IRB, et cetera, version of the white privilege paper, where I take a standard privilege scale and I administer that to 5,000 people, preferably randomly selected, and I really see what affects privilege. And that to some extent is a simple little experiment, but we've heard about this idea of white privilege for 30 years. Is it real? That's something I'd be interested in writing. There are really a bunch of these designed at looking at kind of the joints of a lot of these sociological studies that look good, but that I have questions about. For example, one thing I'd like to do is send resumes to employers that just contain the SAT scores or IQ scores or GPAs of the applicants. People frequently find that Black students are about 11% less likely to get a callback than white students from the same college when they do these anonymized resume submissions with identifiable Black name. It strikes me that 11% is close to exactly the affirmative action edge at most colleges, like right down the line. And I think obvious alternative explanation isn't that people are wild racists. They assume that if you went to U of I and you were Black, you probably got a 1080 SAT instead of a 1200. They assume that because that's the case. So, I mean, I'd be interested in if you just put in SAT 1200 in the achievement section or something like that, whether that gap vanishes entirely. And I think it probably would. That's something I'm interested in doing.
A really interesting question. Very interesting question.
Yeah, I don't think that there's no racism. I think that there's there's very little treatment of the same guy very differently, if that makes sense. I was in the nightlife business in Chicago to fund grad school for a bit. And one of the things that originally shocked me was that clubs would sometimes be, I generally wouldn't work with a club that said this past a certain point, but some clubs were fairly racist. Like, and this wasn't just white clubs, like Black clubs would say, we don't necessarily want young white males, especially soldiers. I had a couple of white clubs say the same thing about young Black males. And no one said this about doctors of the other race or whatever. But I actually, before canceling some contracts, I asked people, why is that? And they said, well, that's what causes all of our fights. We bring in warrior age males of the other group and we're guaranteed to have a brawl breakout. Bring in as many women as you want. You know, so that I think, I still don't approve of it, but that illustrates how racism probably works in practice. If you own a middle-class Black bar, you don't want 15 white Marines showing up because you know your guys are going to react. There's going to be a big fight. Now, is that still technically illegal? Probably. But I think that if you adjust for basic variables, like in that situation, is the guest female? Is there the SAT on the resume that's going into the employer? Most of those racial gaps will simply vanish. That doesn't mean this can't impact you in your life as a Black person or even situationally as a white person. It means that there are very easy ways to respond to what you could almost call rational discrimination rather than just evil bigotry. So I'd be interested in doing that. Another piece comes out of a short experiment I did with my kids, one of my quant classes recently. But I asked people, how many negative experiences would you say you have in a typical month? Arguments, perhaps a challenge to a scuffle, road rage. And the white and Black kids gave identical estimates. In fact, the white kids, who are mostly Appalachian kids, gave a few more unpleasant incidents. Then I asked, how many would you attribute to racial bias in this very integrated city, the Kentucky State Capitol? The Black kids said half of them. The white kids said almost none of them. So I'd be interested in making this more sophisticated and looking at it. Because again, you've got a situation where at least among working class males, Black and white kids experience the same amount of violence, hostility, auto ding on the car, this kind of stuff. But African Americans think that half of these incidents are caused by racism. Why? I mean, that's something I'd be interested in looking at. How much do you use social media? How much do you use mainstream news media? Do you access conservative media? So those are three academic pieces. And I mean, you know, across the board, I plan on doing a lot of sort of public intellectual writing. I have a piece coming out in the Telegraph looking at whether lockdowns work to suppress COVID-19. The answer is sure, while you're locked down. As soon as you stop locking down, you see the curve.
Yeah, you get Europe. Yeah, you get Europe. Right. Meanwhile, you have no economy. But hey, who is counting?
No, but that's everybody, because they're all out of work and have plenty of time on their hands.
Right.
But no, I mean, this is actually, let's see here. I won't waste a lot of time on this, but actually I have Worldometer's coronavirus up on my computer right now for this paper. Let's look at this here. There's some question about whether any approach to coronavirus really makes a massive difference, I would say. So like, I'm looking at the countries right now by deaths per million. And almost every major country is within a pretty narrow range. I mean, there's this idea that the USA does worst in the world. not really. In death per million, Belgium is the worst at 1,185 per million. Then you go through a whole bunch of good-sized countries, Peru, Spain, Brazil, Argentina, UK, USA. But, I mean, they're all in the same range. I mean, the UK has 749 COVID-19 deaths per million people. We have 748. Mexico has 745. Italy has 721. Sweden has 600.
And by the way, if you take out New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, we drop precipitously.
Yeah, no, the USA did not have a terrible response to coronavirus. No. That's another media canard. I mean, we're 12th in the world right now in deaths per million. If you throw in testing, the one time I did this on the back of a matchbook, we fall to about 45th, maybe 50th.
Right.
And that testing matters because in Ghana, you know, fine, civilized second world state, but they're not doing the level of testing we're doing. So people, unfortunately, die. If your death rate increases by 8%, but you're not testing for COVID-19, those just go down as excess deaths, heart attacks, senior strokes, so on. So when you look at how big the country is and the rate of testing that we're engaging in, we have beaten probably 50 of the countries on Earth. There are less than 200 countries on Earth, and most are small. So that entire idea of we're number one, That's just the usual complete misunderstanding of statistics. We are the largest of the countries that's honestly tested. In fact, in terms of overall deaths, that's pretty much what the major players are. I mean, let's look at total deaths here. It's literally USA, Brazil, India, Mexico, Britain, Russia. I mean, those are also, now China's lying, but with China removed from the mix, I mean, that's just a listing of the large countries on Earth. You know, so that, of course, if you have 500 million people, you're going to have more COVID-19 deaths than if you have 500,000 people.
Sure.
I mean, it's a lot of this is, you can, if you control a printing press, much less, you know, a modern series of computer modems and a bullpen, you can create whatever impression you want people to have.
Well, maybe we are on a printing press then, Professor.
I'm thinking about starting some kind of media brand, but the field is so full of them. I mean, the Daily Wire on the right now is going to try to move into, like, they bought PragerU's video library. They have, I mean, I would suspect they're going to start getting into the Netflix sort of model. So, I mean, I think pretty soon you'll have a range of competing media options. But that's sort of the problem. I mean, I'm old enough to remember just the guy, Cronkite, looking at the camera and saying, this is the news. And you understand he's going to be reasonably honest and then shut up after an hour. So that would be, to some extent, the ideal. But what we're going to get is a very diverse, multifaceted world there.
Yeah, Megan Kelly made a point on, I think, Adam Carolla's podcast a week ago that we're simply shifting back to the original media landscape of the beginning of the American Republic, where, you know, there's media, there are newspapers for the Whigs and newspapers for the Democrats and newspapers for the Federalists, et cetera, et cetera. And who knows? I mean, I've always been one who thought that newspapers should be pretty clear about their bias because everybody has one. And so, if the New York Times wants to be liberal, fine. You know, I mean, the Journal wants to be conservative, fine. Just be honest about that. Don't tell me that don't lie to me that you're objective. But in any case, I'm going to let you go because you probably have some things to do other than talk to me. But I'm once again thrilled that we talked. I mean, you're a wonderfully agile mind and what I enjoy too is you ask great questions that you would then want to go and research. Can't wait to see some of those articles. And let me just sign off. Remember, people out there, there's two books that Professor Riley has written, Hate Crime, Hoax, and Taboo. And they're both great reads. And they really are important books to read because, you know, they're filled with stuff that you don't get in the mainstream media. And unlike an awful lot of journalism, these books are not fact-free. They're fact-filled. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast. Remember to go to successmadetolast.com to register for our newsletter, filled with fun information about our future guests and great stuff in general. And go to your podcast distributor and rate our show, please. Till next time, go out there and live the best version of you. Cheers.
So let me tell you a little bit about Blinkist. Blinkist is the most useful app on my phone. And it's really hard to find time to sit down and read and learn more. And when you don't have free time, you can't read or work on personal development. There's this incredible app that solves this problem, and I highly recommend it. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is really unique. It works on my iPhone, and it could work on your tablet or web browser as well. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. Successful people, like business leaders, are well-known for reading lots of books, and Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of a book quickly so you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute or lunch break or while you exercise. There's 12 million plus people using Blinkist right now, and it's got a growing library of self-help, business, health, history books. And you can go to Blinkist.com to see some of the latest titles. I like Blinkist because listening to some of the most popular books that I just haven't found time to get to, including Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow and Super Thinking by Gabe Weinberg. Two great books. So right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. You can go to Blinkist.com/success and try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/success to start your free 7-day trial today. Give it a shot. You will love microburst learning from Blinkist.